I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, said that 2012 has been the hottest year in the United States in more than a century, and we still have 5 months to go. Two-thirds of the continental United States is facing moderate to severe drought conditions. Satellite imagery found that Greenland's ice sheet melt has jumped dramatically this summer at a pace not seen in three decades. A chunk of ice two times the size of Manhattan broke loose from a glacier in northwestern Greenland. What's going on? Is extreme weather here to stay? Is it being caused by climate change? That's our topic for today's Radio Times, and we have two guests, one of whom joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Michael Lemonick, a senior writer for Climate Central, lead author of their new book called Global Weirdness: Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Droughts, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. He's a contributing writer for Time magazine. He's got a new book coming out in the fall called Mirror Earth: The Search for Our Planet's Twin. And Michael Lemonick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
And joining us by telephone is Chris Field, founding director of the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology, also professor of biology and environmental earth system science at Stanford University. He's currently the co-chair of the IPCC Working Group 2, which just released the report called Managing the Risks of Extreme Events and Disasters to Advance Climate Change Adaptation. And Chris Field, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Michael, let me begin with you, and we have much to talk about. Is it possible then to connect the dots between all this hot weather, the floods we've had, the drought conditions, some of these severe storms that have affected the U.S. and other countries around the world? Is it possible to see how one of these are all connected together?
Well, it's hard to connect them in an absolutely concrete way. What we can say, I think, and since we have a real scientist on the line, who can correct me, what we can say is that all of this is consistent with the idea that global warming is pushing our climate system into a new regime, that these things that we're seeing, many of these things are coming more often, more severe, especially heat waves, more severely, and are likely to get worse in the future. Not that we didn't have heat waves. You know, it's July or it's August. It's summer. We have heat waves. This is not shocking, but the effect of human generated greenhouse gases is pushing that in a new direction.
Chris Field, do we have evidence that the Earth is warming?
Absolutely. Back in 2007, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is basically a collaboration among all the world's scientists, concluded that warming the climate system is unequivocal. They couldn't really think of a stronger phrasing to use. There's no question that the Earth has warmed over the last century. And the warming does produce consequences for a wide range of the things that we see as everyday weather events, including extremes and disasters.
And how much has the Earth warmed in the last century? Do we know?
The global average over both land and oceans has been about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit, about 0.85 degrees Celsius. In the land has warmed by somewhat more than that. It's warmed by about 2 Fahrenheit since 1900.
And clearly, I'm not a scientist, but why does 1.5 degrees of warmth create this extreme weather that we're seeing?
Well, there are a couple of ways that can make it easier to think about. The first is that we're really pushing the odds. If you think about the risk of an accident, an automobile, the faster you go, the more risk of an accident there is. And you can think that we're just kind of loading the climate system toward producing these extremes in much the way that speeding in a car increases the risk of an unfavorable outcome. And another way to think about it is that the warming is basically loading energy into an atmosphere, especially a moist atmosphere. And you could almost think about a warm, moist atmosphere as being like a keg of gunpowder, in that represents an energy quantity that can be released. And sometimes it's released in relatively benign ways, and sometimes it's released in relatively catastrophic ways.
Going back to you, Michael, and you write about the impact of CO2 on the climate, but you also talk about the health of corals, looking at tree rings, looking at ice cores, looking at the floor of the ocean as evidence for where we can see the impact of global warming.
Yeah. So what Chris is talking about is the effect of what temperature rise we've seen already. But if we're going to try and figure out what's going to happen in the future, we have to look actually to the past at times when the climate changed for purely natural reasons. So at the time of the dinosaurs, the Earth was much warmer than it is today. Of course, no humans there driving SUVs at the time. At the time of the Neanderthals, it was much colder. We were in an ice age. And what scientists are able to do is look back to those times to see what the relationship was between the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere specifically, and the global temperature and the global sea level, and to get an idea of what the past could tell us about where we might be heading.
And can you literally look at, for instance, the start of the Industrial Revolution? I mean, is there evidence looking in the past where you can see that shift?
I believe you can actually see the atmosphere start to change in samples taken from ice laid down at that time. And by that time in the Industrial Revolution, people were already taking samples of atmosphere and looking at the gases in them. You know, it was in the it was before 1850, I believe, that the relationship between carbon dioxide and heat was established. We actually knew CO2 was a heat-trapping gas in the 1800s. So this is very, very firmly established science.
Chris Field, do you want to add to that as our resident scientist here?
Well, what Michael says is exactly right, that in 1896, there was a definitive study published by a brilliant Swedish chemist named Svante Arrhenius. And Arrhenius was measuring the absorption of heat by carbon dioxide and was wondering about what had caused the ice ages. And what he realized was that this absorption of heat by carbon dioxide could be a strong lever pushing the climate around. And it's remarkable how in 1896, most of the key pieces of the puzzle of the way that heat-trapping gases influence climate were already understood. For example, Arrhenius knew that the effect of the carbon dioxide would be amplified by having more water vapor in the atmosphere, because a warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor, and water vapor is another heat-trapping gas. Arrhenius also knew that much of the CO2 that was emitted by combustion of coal at that point would result in CO2 uptake by the ocean, acidifying the oceans, but removing some of the CO2 from the atmosphere. And when Arrhenius took a calculation of the amount of warming you would expect from a doubling of CO2, he didn't get it exactly right, but it was reasonably close. Mm. So the fundamental physics have really been known now for more than a century.
And would it be fair to say that the climate scientists are in general or maybe unanimous agreement about climate change and global warming?
Well, climate is unique in the sciences in that we really have a profoundly comprehensive assessment system in place. So through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we really have a vehicle by which all the world's climate scientists can weigh in to evaluate the evidence on what we know and what we don't know. It wouldn't be fair to say that every climate scientist agrees on every aspect of the overall picture, but the overwhelming consensus is that the climate system has warmed, that greenhouse gases are likely responsible for the large majority of that warming, and that warming will continue in the future with a variety of consequences, including a few that are positive, but many, many that are negative moving into the future, especially if greenhouse gas emissions continue unabated.
And Michael, you write in this book that the climate science is relatively new and still learning about the climate that we live in.
Right, and that is sometimes taken by critics as an excuse to say, well, they don't know everything, so why should we take any action to limit greenhouse gases? And it's really important to make a distinction between not knowing everything and knowing an awful lot. Mm-hmm. As Chris says, they're still learning about the climate system. We're still understanding how it operates, but the basics have been known for more than 100 years. Arrhenius, by the way, thought it was a good thing because he thought the burning of coal might and the warming of the atmosphere might stave off the next ice age. So we've known the basics for a long time. Some of the details in the numbers are not that well known. In 2007, the IPCC report, the last major report for the IPCC, made a projection about future sea level rise, but there was a footnote or an asterisk saying that this does not take into account changes in ice sheet dynamics. So it didn't take into account the fact that the ice on Greenland in particular might start moving more quickly. Since that time, we've learned even more, and the projections have gone up.
Well, let me ask you about Greenland, Chris Field, because some of the satellite imagery is showing pretty dramatic ice melt in Greenland. Why is that significant?
A lot of the reason that we care so much about the major ice sheets and instability of the ice sheets is that the ice that's sitting on them represents the potential for quite an impressive amount of sea level rise. The Greenland ice sheet has enough water in it that if that water moves from the ice sheet to the oceans, we would raise global sea level by something like 20 feet.
Whoa.
20 feet. That's whoa. Really a lot.
And I just said, whoa, and, yes, indeed.
And there is not much risk that we're going to see a 20-foot sea level rise over the next few years, but there really is the accumulating body of evidence that we may not be that far from being committed to the eventual loss of the Greenland ice sheet. A huge amount of research is going into it now, and with every year as we're able to get more and more refined measurements of the changes in the ice volume, and certainly the recent observations of the massive melt we're seeing are pushing all the scientists back to the computer models and to their measurement devices to make sure that they are incorporating all the information to see where we are in that process and whether or not we can identify where the tipping point is, where we're committed to the eventual loss.
Mike, I know that Climate Central looked at this issue of sea rise, I guess ice melt / sea rise. What did you find?
Well, so Climate Central did a report, a study of sea level rise, but coupled it to where population is actually located in the United States, because it's fine to say sea level is going to go up by 1 foot or 3 feet or whatever, but to understand how that might impact you personally, it's very hard to judge. So what we did was, what our scientists did, was to take projections from the IPCC and other organizations of where how much sea level was likely to rise over the next 50 to 100 years, couple that with census maps showing where people actually live, the number of people that live within a certain altitude above sea level, and then add one more factor, which is the likelihood of storm surges when a tropical storm or a hurricane or even just an ordinary nor'easter comes in from the ocean. It pushes a wall of water ahead of it. Hurricane Katrina didn't really cause any damage from wind or rain. It caused damage from storm surge. We put all those together to predict the risk.
And I want to pick up on what you found after this very short break, talking with Michael Lemonick and Chris Field about extreme weather and climate change. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Hispanic Institute at LaSalle University supports WHYY and announces a new master's program in translation and interpretation that addresses three main environments: business, legal, and healthcare, where translation and interpretation involving English and Spanish is currently needed and will continue to be in the future. Details at 215-951-1100 or lasalle.edu/Hispanic Institute. LaSalle University. Choose LaSalle for your master's in translation and interpretation.
He was an outsider. He challenged the art world by collecting the new masters and giving them a home. More Cézanne than the Louvre, and the world's largest collection of Renoir. Dr. Albert Barnes and his grand experiment in education, the Barnes Collection, the WHYY original production, proud to be part of the PBS Arts Summer Festival. The Barnes Collection, Friday night at 9 on WHYY-TV. See a preview at whyy.org/barnes.
Gymnast Dominique Mochianu was the youngest member of the U.S. 1996 Olympic women's dream team, but that path to glory was often filled with physical and emotional pain, and that's a story she's been waiting to tell.
The time has come where I felt my story was necessary to share, and it took me 7 years to get it all out.
Gymnastic legend Dominique Mochianu on her new book, Off Balance. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about some of the strange weather we've been having, what we can expect, how we can live with it, and how we can turn the tide on global warming. Our guests are Michael Lemonick. He's with us in our Philadelphia studio, senior writer for Climate Central, lead author of their new book called Global Weirdness. He's a contributing writer for Time Magazine, has a new book coming out in the fall called Mirror Earth. Also with us and joining us by telephone is Chris Field, founding director of the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology. He's also a professor of biology and environmental earth system science at Stanford University. And I'll do this just one more time. Currently the co-chair of the IPCC Working Group 2 just released their report. It's called Managing the Risks of Extreme Events and Disasters to Advance Climate Change Adaptation. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Michael, you talked about this report looking at sea rise, looking at all the people, millions, billions of people living along coastlines. So what were the findings?
Well, I can't give you the detailed findings because they are so particular to each individual area. But overall, we show that within the next 30 years or so, I believe is the number, a very large number, millions, many millions of Americans are actually at risk from a severe flooding event caused by a combination of sea level rise and storm surges. The kind of storm surges that come with any kind of major storm. And what you can actually do is go to the website sealevel.climatecentral.org, and there's an interactive map where you can enter your own zip code and find out what your risk actually is.
Chris Field, let me go back to you. And you know, we're trying to do a show that's not hysterical about climate change and global warming. Nonetheless, it's hard not to be concerned about what we face in the future. And as you had indicated, even if we were to stop production of CO2 today, the process that we're seeing would still continue into the future. How worried are you?
Well, I would like to see everyone have the information necessary to make good decisions about their lives and their future and their children's future. And one of the conclusions of the special IPCC report that I just coordinated is that there are a wide range of smart decisions that could be taken now and decisions that don't necessarily cost a lot. We can divide the solution space into two big areas. One is adaptation, things we can do to cope more effectively with the climate changes that can't be avoided, a wide range of those we could talk about later.
Sure.
And the other class is mitigation, things we can do in order to slow or reverse the pace of climate change. And there are a wide range of things that could be taken in that part of the solution space.
And what would be a basic thing that we should all think about doing in terms of mitigation?
I think of the mitigation space as being like the four walls of a house. There are four big kinds of steps that can be taken. One is conservation. The conservation is things that we might do now that we could do without. Do you need to take that one extra business trip, or could you do it by a phone call? The second category that we can use to reduce emissions is efficiency, switching to more efficient cars, light bulbs, buildings. Wide range of opportunities. There are opportunities that often save money, creating a win-win type of situation. A third category of opportunities in the solution space involves carbon capture and storage, ways that we might still utilize fossil fuels, but instead of using the atmosphere as the dumping place for the waste products, stabilize the waste products in geological formations or deep in the oceans. And then the fourth category of opportunities in the solution space involves transitions to an energy system that don't release greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, things like wind, solar, biomass energy, and again, a wide range of opportunities there that are economically attractive as well as protective of the climate.
You want to add to that, Michael?
I don't have any more walls.
Those were the four walls.
I mean,
walls.
That's a good way of thinking of it. And I guess the question is, I agree with all of these things. Mm-hmm. The real question is whether people are likely to support them and to take those actions. And one incentive that has been proposed a lot to get people to be more willing to do it and companies to be more willing to supply these services is some sort of carbon tax or a cap and trade system. And that politically, that's just very, very difficult. On the other hand, if it's more expensive for people to emit carbon, they will naturally find other solutions that turn out to be economical and even profitable for businesses.
But what I hear you both saying is that we have to figure out how to get off of fossil fuels, fuels so much of our economy, though.
Well, energy fuels our economy, and yes, we use fossil fuels to do that. In the United States, we use petroleum for transportation and for other purposes. That's our worst addiction in terms of fossil fuels. Coal is another one. And it is true that we could still use those fuels if we managed to capture the carbon before it went into the air. But scaling up to a level where we can actually make a dent in those emissions by capturing carbon, that's a big project. And a lot of these things are big projects.
But is it also a goal, even necessity, to explain to the public what is going on so that they can... I'm thinking about those no smoking campaigns where government and came together and said smoking is bad for you.
You know, this is an analogy I actually use quite a lot. If you remember the 1960s, which I do...
Me too.
The idea that there would be no smoking on airplanes, no smoking in restaurants, no smoking in any public places, no smoking hotels, it would be inconceivable. People would never have stood for it. I mean, it would have just been just unimaginable. And yet, after a number of years of explaining to people what the hazards were from smoking and really getting people to get it, to really understand this was a problem, politicians have been empowered to pass these laws and to create these regulations, and nobody, very few people, get upset about it. And I think you're exactly right. Getting people to understand what the stakes are is a really big step toward making those kinds of laws and regulations acceptable.
Chris, anything you want to add to that? And then I do want to get to our callers.
Well, it is almost certainly true that there are going to be some kinds of incentives will be necessary to generate a movement away from the energy systems that are using the atmosphere as a waste dump. But there are also a tremendous number of opportunities. You know, we're at the start of a century where it's almost certain that by the end we're going to be looking at a wide range of non-fossil-based energy sources. I think every country should be aspiring to be the leader in the technologies that provide that energy from non-fossil sources.
And I guess, I mean, this is a more political question, whether there is, and I don't know how deep you want to get into this, Christus, whether there is that political will to do what both you and Michael are saying.
You know, at this point, we would be tremendously far ahead of where we are now to just have a level playing field, to just have a situation where every new technology had a minimum of barriers and a fair access to subsidies. I mean, and at this point, you know, the energy systems that we've had for the past many decades take advantage of a variety of subsidies of established infrastructure that gives them a real leg up. And just leveling the playing field would make a big difference. Beyond that, there are going to be some additional steps that are necessary. But society is only going to go so long using the atmosphere as a waste dump, particularly as more and more of the consequences of that action build up.
And that's Chris Field, who joins us along with Michael Lemonick. We're talking about some of the weird, strange weather we've been having, whether it's droughts or floods or heavy rainfall. And we're certainly talking about heat as well. According to NOAA, 2012 has been the hottest year in the U.S. in more than a century. And we're talking about what is going on and what we can do about it. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions, do give us a call. We have Larry from Warminster joining us on Radio Times. Larry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're
and
welcome.
I think the IPCC reports have been wonderful. I want to ask Chris, since Greenland, and I've been following the melting up in the Arctic for about 25 years, Greenland and Ellesmere Island seem to be melting in an exponential way. So what's the possibility of seeing something like a 1 meter sea level rise in the next decade?
We touched on this earlier, but Chris, you want to add to that?
Sure. It's very difficult to predict the rate of ice melting. If it were just a big ice cube that were sitting on a plate, the physics lets us explain it in great detail. But what actually happens with a continental scale ice mask like we have on Greenland is that there are a whole bunch of processes that can either amplify or slow the rate. For example, we know now that with continental ice sheets, that once the surface starts to melt, the water runs down underneath the ice and kind of creates a lubricating layer that allows the ice to move more quickly. We know in addition that as the ring of ice around the edge of the island begins to melt, that it allows the ice in the center to move more quickly. Trying to get a handle on all those things is really challenging. Mm-hmm. I would say that what most of the conclusions point to now is that there are processes that accelerate the ice melting beyond what we had anticipated only a few years ago. But I think it's also unlikely that these processes will accelerate it by the orders of magnitude that would be required for a 1 meter sea level rise over a decade or so. The range of sea level rise that the IPCC talked about in its 2007 report was on the order of a few tens of centimeters, about 1 foot to maybe about 2 feet over a century. I don't know where the next range of projections are likely to come out, but I don't think that they're going to be different by a factor of 10. I think that we'll see adjustments, but adjustments that are at the scale of something more modest.
Michael, let me ask you, why do we see temperature rising faster at the poles, North and South Pole, than the rest of the Earth?
Well, one reason is that, and especially at the North Pole, one reason is that in the summertime, warmer air temperatures and warmer ocean temperatures are causing the ice in the Arctic Ocean, in particular, to melt back and expose water more than it has in the past. And when that water is exposed, it absorbs heat much more efficiently than the ice does. This is a process called Arctic amplification. And so that warmer ocean then warms the air and causes temperatures to rise over the ocean and in surrounding areas, and it makes it more likely that you'll have meltback the following year. This summer, in fact, I believe at this moment we have the lowest level of ice for this time of year. Wow. Since we started taking satellite recordings in the late 70s, and in 2007 we had the greatest meltback overall. So the oceans are absorbing more heat in the Arctic, and that has a ripple effect.
And does that create a more acid ocean as well?
Well, it's the more acid ocean is in the oceans worldwide, and it's caused by the absorption of extra CO2 into the seawater. So, yes, it's happening in the Arctic, but it's happening everywhere else.
Let me get, looks like Rick from Hokesson to join us. And Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Thank you for hosting the show, Marty.
Sure.
It's always interesting.
Thank
and
you.
I am a believer in global warming, but I find that the and these two distinguished gentlemen, I find they're a little bit one-dimensional, and it's also easy for people to understand that the sea level is going to rise, but it's not a teacup, and it's, all things are not equal in the sea. And equally, it doesn't talk very much about what the change will make to the landmass. and there is a reserve, if you will, of water under the ground and in the clouds. And no one talks about that. I never hear a word about that.
And
so,
Rick,
it would be interesting.
It would be. And are you talking about Greenland? Is that what, when you talk about reserves?
Yeah. If Greenland declines, I never. If the ice pack melts, as they're describing,
right?
There's going to be a distribution around the world, but never. Everyone only talks about the sea. Never talk about what's going to happen. I mean, we have enormous deserts in the world, such as in the Sahara, in Peru, in Russia, Mongolia. How is that going to impact them? There might be a decline. Okay. There's no prediction there.
Well,
I'll take my answer.
Okay, Rick, I'm actually looking at you, Michael. We both have a slightly quizzical look on our face, but would sea rise in any way affect deserts?
No, I think there are a few ideas mixed up there. The comment that this ocean's not a teacup may be a very astute one. In fact, when we talk about a global sea level rise of 2 or 3 feet, you might think that it will rise 2 or 3 feet everywhere. But in fact, that's not the case. In some places, the land itself is rising or falling very slowly, but that affects the level of the rate of sea level rise. And in fact, it's still rebounding from the weight lifted off it 10,000 years ago when the glaciers disappeared. So some places, the land is actually rising and sea level could actually fall. In other places, ocean currents may be changing, and that could impact the local sea level rise. So if the Gulf Stream slows down, as it is appears to be likely to do, water will back up behind it, and the sea level rise along the east coast of the U.S. will be higher than the average. Another almost crazy-sounding thing is that as Greenland, the ice on Greenland disappears, it has gravity. The ice itself has gravity, and it pulls seawater toward it from all directions. So right now, sea level is higher in and around Greenland than it would naturally be. If that ice disappears, the gravity goes away, and that water relaxes, and sea level will actually go down in the area of Greenland.
Chris Field, I'm curious whether if it's possible to create a cloud system to help cool the Earth. Is that even in the range of possibility?
You know, there are a lot of scientists who are asking whether or not we might have access to other kinds of technologies that would be kind of a plan B or maybe a plan C, D, E, or F. Mm-hmm. And we know that when there have been major volcanic eruptions in the past, volcanoes that have injected large amounts of tiny particles into the atmosphere, that we have seen temporary cooling. When Mount Pinatubo erupted in the early 1990s, we saw a whole year where the global average temperature went down by several tenths of a degree. And that stimulated interest in asking whether or not we might pollute part of the atmosphere on purpose in order to hold temperatures down. The area where the research is really just beginning, and it obviously is an area with lots of leverage over lots of big processes, so one would want to be very careful before even thinking about advocating particular policies. But the research indicates two things, the research we've done so far, is that one, you can think about putting particles, and these could be particles of water, they could be particles of salt or particles of other chemicals into the atmosphere that would be likely to cool the atmosphere, but they also would produce a range of other consequences, and in particular, they would change where it rained and where it didn't, and that's the part of the whole idea of what's often called geoengineering that's most frightening to most scientists, is that we could end up with a situation in which we might even successfully prevent the warming, but also end up with profound and unacceptable changes in something like where it rained and where it didn't.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Chris Field and Michael Lemonick. We are talking about weather and climate and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bristol Riverside Theater supports WHYY and presents Alan Saphir as George Burns in Say Goodnight, Gracie, August 3rd through the 5th. George Burns spanned over 90 years of American entertainment history. The Tony-nominated Say Goodnight, Gracie is based on the life-affirming love story of George Burns and his wife, Gracie Allen. For tickets, 215-785-0100 or at brtstage.org.
The new HBO documentary About Face features supermodels of the past, reflecting on their careers and on aging. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Beverly Johnson, the first African-American woman to be on the cover of Vogue, and Carol Alt, who's been on over 500 covers, and director Timothy Greenfield Sanders, who's photographed everyone from Barbara Bush to porn stars. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
On the next Voices in the Family, we dip into our archives to bring you conversations with two local psychologists who've published new books this year. Tamar Chansky is one of the nation's leading experts on anxiety disorder, and Scott Browning is a noted authority on stepfamily therapy. Voices in the Family, today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Michael Lemonick. He's a, we need to pull down that, we need to pull down, we need to figure out how to pull down the microphone in the control room. If our engineer can take care of that, hold on, I'm sorry. Okay. We're talking with Michael Lemonick, and he's a senior writer for Climate Central, lead author of their new book called Global Weirdness. There we go. A contributing writer for Time Magazine. He's got a new book called Mirror Earth coming out in the fall. Also with us is Chris Field. He's founding director of the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology and a professor of biology and environmental earth system science at Stanford University. Much going on here, including things happening in our control room. And we're also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Michael, let me put a couple of things to you before we get back to our callers. One thing that I read in your in the book that you are the lead author of is that our growing season has been extended by about 2 weeks, and I would say as someone who grows veggies in my backyard, I have been witnessing that. Is that a terrible thing?
Well, you know, that in itself is not a terrible thing, and as Chris mentioned, there are some good things that, that come out of global warming for some people. The problem is that and spring is coming earlier. That's the major reason, I think, for the extended growing season across much of North America. Problem is that, say, in the Mountain West, the spring is coming earlier there, too. The mountain, the snowpack on top of the mountains is melting, starting to melt earlier and fill the streams earlier. And those streams dry out earlier in the summer than they used to. And that is a real problem for drinking water supplies, for agriculture, and also for the fire season, which is getting longer in the West. There's less water. Another problem is that as temperatures warm earlier, some species of animals and plants react more strongly than others. And in an ecosystem, in many ecosystems where they've coordinated over thousands and thousands of years to time the arrival of the birds and the all of these natural mm-hmm. processes work together, so the birds get there just as the worms are emerging from, I'm making up biology,
of course,
but from the ground. But it's that sort of thing, and now the birds are maybe not getting there. They're getting there at the same time, but the worms are out earlier and they're all gone, and so there's actually been serious disruptions to ecosystems around the world as the timing of these events is skewed.
But does that, and this gets back to something you were referring to earlier, Chris Field, I mean, humans have been adapting for thousands and thousands of years to a changing climate. Is it possible we just have to adapt to a future environment that doesn't look like today's?
John Holdren is the president's science advisor, and John very appropriately says there are three things we can do in the face of climate change. We can either adapt, we can mitigate, or we can suffer. And if we don't do either adaptation or mitigation, what we end up doing is suffering. Mm-hmm. We end up not being aware of the challenges and not taking the steps that are necessary. There's a lot that can be done with adaptation, things like planting varieties that can deal with longer growing systems, being more careful about the way we manage irrigation water in agriculture. But there are also limits to how much we can do with adaptation. You know, it has to rain in order to be able to grow a crop. You need to not have massive hailstorms in order to be able to bring in the wheat. And so it's important to recognize that even though there are big opportunities, opportunities for adaptation, there's a limit to how far those can go.
Go ahead, Michael. Well, so you want to say something?
Well, I was going to say that it's often pointed out by people skeptical of the fact that we're in danger, that the humans have adapted to major climate changes in the past. You know, we lived through the Ice Age, and then we came out of the Ice Age. But people fail to realize that the population is much, much, much larger now, and that we've got enormous trillions upon trillions of dollars worth of infrastructure in specific locations. So if sea level rises, 3 feet, all of the coastal cities that are, I mean, you can't just move the city a couple of feet. You could have moved your campground if you were a Neanderthal. You can't move the growing farm infrastructure of the American Midwest up to Canada if the temperature shifts or the rainfall shifts, and build new roads and build new everything. We are very firmly entrenched in an infrastructure based on assumptions about the climate, and the climate is changing more quickly now than it has at any time, mm-hmm. I think, in human history.
So the consequences are dramatically
It's just much more difficult
greater.
To adapt.
Let me also ask you, Michael, just quickly, if you don't mind, and then I do want to get back to our callers, all those pictures from the Midwest of those dried up corn stalks that we see, and I'm also thinking about the Dust Bowl days. I wasn't alive, but certainly read about and have seen pictures of the Dust Bowl in the Midwest. Are there some parallels there from your perspective?
Well, there are parallels. There are a couple of parallels. One is that the Dust Bowl era was caused by shorter-term climate fluctuations that don't have much to do with climate change. So changes in Pacific currents like El Nino and La Nina, and the devastating effect of the Dust Bowl came in part from very uneducated farming practices that destroyed topsoil and allowed it all to blow away. So we know a lot more now, and this is in line with what Chris was talking about. Adaptation and different kinds of farming practices. We learned from that to farm in a way that made it much less likely for something like that to happen. The current drought, I believe, is in part caused by those same natural climate variations, but it's all being accentuated by the warming of the earth.
That's El Nino
and La Nina, and I never get them straight.
Can you get them straight, Chris, and then we'll get back to our callers. What should we know about them?
The big, you can think about them as they're like big arms that are pushing the climate system back and forth on a kind of a semi-regular sort of 4 to 7 year basis. El Nino is warm water against the coast of California and Central America. La Nina is cold water. What we know is that those La Nina creates colder temperatures across the world on average. El Nino creates warmer temperatures. But what we're beginning to see is that climate change is altering the consequences of those events. There was a very nice paper that was just published a few weeks ago that was analyzing the factors that were contributing to the very devastating 2011 drought in Texas. And what this study concluded, a brilliant piece of detective work in the science of attribution, is that in a La Nina condition, which was certainly contributing to the Texas drought of 2011, climate change has now made the extreme heat that they saw that year at least 20 times more likely than it was in the 1960s. It's not that we have more La Ninas, it's that extreme heat during a La Nina is now much more likely.
Interesting. Let me get, looks like Alan from Bear, Delaware, to join us. And Alan, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question to the two speakers, the panel, is when the permafrost in the northern hemisphere of Siberia and Canada and Alaska starts warming up, will it produce the tons of methane that are being predicted? And how is that going to accelerate the melting of the ice sheet in the northern hemisphere during the summer? And on a second note, once we start getting sea level rise, which is already occurring, how is that going to affect the calving of the Antarctic ice sheets? Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Alan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We haven't really talked about methane, and if I can toss that first to you, Michael Lemonick, and then to you, Chris Field.
Yeah, so as permafrost starts melting in the Arctic, and we're already seeing that happen, organic matter that's been trapped there for many thousands of years is going to start to decompose. And depending on whether it's in a swampy area or a non-swampy area, it will decompose into either methane or carbon dioxide. Mm. And methane in particular is a very powerful greenhouse gas. It doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long as CO2, but it's much more efficient at trapping heat while it's there. So yes, it is not unlikely that we will see methane releases and CO2 releases from the permafrost as the climate warms, and that will tend to accelerate the warming.
Accelerate the warming. Chris, again, anything you want to add to that?
I think there are a couple of things that are worth keeping in mind. The first is that the amount of carbon that's frozen in these frozen soils is basically, you can think about it as broccoli that was moved into an icebox 20,000 years ago. It is at least three times the amount that's in the atmosphere today, and it's about five times as much as we have released in fossil fuel combustion as long as we've burned fossil fuels. Huh. A vast amount of carbon. And the other thing that we know is that as these frozen soils are thawed, the carbon can be released to the atmosphere by decomposition very quickly. It really is similar to the analogy of taking broccoli out of the icebox and having it rot on your kitchen counter. So there are a number of Earth system processes that are poised to make the climate change situation more challenging. The warmer it gets, the more we're likely to get a vicious cycle-type feedback where the land and ocean either take up less CO2 or they release CO2 to the atmosphere.
Alan, thanks for the call. Let's see what Mary from Berwyn has to say. Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air, Mary.
Oh, yes. Well, there was an article in the paper not long ago, a few days ago, actually, about how the water vapor caused by summer storms threatens the ozone layer by activating some of the fluorocarbons that were up there when we and are still there. And when the vapor gets up there, it reactivates those fluorocarbons and weakens the ozone layer.
Well, Mary, it's a good question. I'm going to toss that first to you, Michael Lemonet.
Yes. What that paper actually said was that there's now good evidence that thunderstorms inject moisture very high up into the atmosphere, something people hadn't really understood before, and that it's theoretically possible that this could affect the ozone layer, but it has not yet been established that this actually happens in the real world. So this is a very important paper. It's something to investigate, but we should not. There may be something we are not thinking of that would prevent the ozone depletion from happening. So it's not quite time to panic yet.
Chris Field, this is sort of a very down-to-earth question, but if the Earth is getting warm, and it certainly feels that way, and the evidence seems to point to that as well, people use more air conditioning. Does that create a kind of a cycle in and of itself?
It does.
Does it?
That's exactly a kind of mechanism that in many cases the Earth produces. So, you know, you think about it this way. If it's really hot, people turn on air conditioning, and it could be life-saving when the conditions are brutally hot. But that air conditioning runs on electricity that's produced in a coal-fired power plant. The coal-fired power plant is releasing heat-trapping gases to the atmosphere that are amplifying the situation. In the grand scheme of things, at least so far, air conditioning isn't what you can think of as a major lever on the climate system, but as more and more people become wealthier and wealthier and generate more and more demand for air conditioning, it really has the potential to be a major factor. One of the real challenges, and I think one of the real opportunities, is to figure out how to design buildings so they need less air conditioning.
Michael, it's interesting. We're in the beginnings of a presidential campaign. It's been pretty fast and furious, but no one has talked about climate change, global warming, whatever you want to call it. It and even in the previous campaign, that always seems to take a backseat to some of these other issues, important issues, some not so important. But it's so interesting that climate change does not get the kind of intense coverage that I hear both of you saying that it should.
Right. Well, I'm not an expert on politics, and when I was on the staff at Time, if they threw me a politics story, I panicked.
Okay. Don't panic. I don't want you to panic.
Yeah, give me quantum physics anytime.
Okay.
That
All right.
I can understand. But I guess the candidates have made a calculation that it's not going to help them politically, and it might hurt them to talk about these issues. And their the goal is to get elected.
Yeah. What do you think, Chris Field?
Well, thanks, Marty, for doing a show on it. I think that unless people understand the issue and hear about it, it's not going to be a campaign issue. And I think that the factor that's going to be essential if it does become an issue in this and successive campaigns is for individuals around the world to say they really care deeply about the issue. And my personal feeling is that as people become more and more educated, they'll be able to make their own decisions about where it ought to be in the spectrum of need and potential for really making a difference in elections.
But should we be afraid, be very afraid, Chris Field?
This is an important problem. It's an important problem that's calling out for us to make smart decisions based on good information. The last thing we should be doing is putting our head in the sand and saying, I hope it goes away. But it's not that we need to be afraid. It's we need to be smart, aggressive, and ambitious.
Do you agree with that, Michael Emmerich?
I do agree with that. And you know, people who are afraid, well, as Chris said, put their head in the sands, or they just don't want to think about it. They push it out of their minds. And it is a manageable problem. It's not an easy problem to manage, but we can manage it if we actually sit down and take it on.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Chris Field, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marty.
And he's you're welcome. And he's the founding director of the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology. He's also a professor of biology and environmental earth system science at Stanford University, currently the co-chair of the IPCC Working Group 2. And they just released a report. It's called Managing the Risks of Extreme Events and Disasters to Advance Climate Change Adaptation. Michael Lemonick, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, coming down to Philadelphia.
Always a pleasure.
And he's senior writer for Climate Central, lead author of their new book called Global Weirdness, Severe Storms, Deadly Heat Waves, Relentless Droughts, Rising Seas, and the Weather of the Future. He's a contributing writer for Time Magazine, and he's got a new book coming out in the fall called Mirror Earth, The Search for Our Planet's Twin. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoyne. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.